On this episode of No Cap Room, Patrick Redford from Defector joins us to talk about compliment sandwiches, energy-generating behaviors, and post-All-Star break storylines from around the NBA that we'll be paying attention to. All that and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room, the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast that's not sure if what fans want is to be educated or entertained, but we're not promising to do either. My name is Dan Devine. I'm a senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. And the reason I'm talking first today is that my partner, the People's Insider, Jake Fisher, is not here. He is off gallivanting somewhere, probably chasing a juicy story or two. That means that I'm in the big chair this week. And it also means I need someone else to talk to, which means I am welcoming an esteemed and illustrious guest to the program today. We are lucky enough to be joined by a phenomenal writer whose work has appeared in publications ranging from The Guardian, True Hoop, Vice Sports, The Classical, New York Magazine, 538, and of course, most frequently and wonderfully, Deadspin. He is now a staff writer and co-founder, co-owner of Defector, where he writes beautifully about all sorts of stuff, including the NBA. Friends, a warm welcome for Patrick Redford. Patrick, how you doing today? Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for that intro. Wow.
That's a big part of the value proposition of me, is that I try to make people feel good right up top, because I know it's all going downhill from there.
It's like a compliment sandwich kind of thing, you know? Start me off well, rake me over the coals, and at the end say, thanks for coming. So I'm so ready for this.
It's definitely, I'm a pretty big purveyor of gotcha journalism. So I hope you're prepared for the next 40 minutes to be sort of a Frost Nixon type deal.
Yeah, I listened to some previous episodes. You know, I'm a listener, did some prep. So I'm ready for your little traps.
For the tricks and traps that I set. Well, it'll be a real game of cat and mouse. That's good. Before we get too far afield, I want to make sure, first people know, like, I am a subscriber to Defector. I'm a fan of the site. But for folks who might not be familiar with it, can you kind of give the elevator pitch introduction to what Defector is and why they might want to support it?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two reasons. There's one, I think we're the largest worker-owned media organization in the United States. Wow. We have no investors. We own the whole shop. It's all, you know, the writers you know and love from Deadspin who all quit at the same time. There's like a very long version of that story. The short one is we started our own thing now, and it's going great. There's so much good stuff on there. Sports is like the meat and potatoes of the site, but there's a ton more, and we're always adding new writers and new voices, and I'm biased, but I think it's great. And, you know, you're unbiased and you think it's great. So maybe that holds more water.
I would hope so. But yeah, you are right to be biased in your own direction. It's a wonderful site with great things there every day on a wide variety of topics. So yes, defector.com. I heartily suggest that people support it like I do. And now that we've gotten the butter you up portion of it out of the way, now we've buttered the first piece of the compliment sandwich. Patrick, I've asked you here today because the All-Star break is now blessedly over. We're recording on Thursday afternoon. NBA games resume tonight. And that means it's time to talk through some of the storylines and assorted things we'll be paying attention to down the home stretch of the NBA season. But first, just a quick news blurb here. During the All-Star break, one of the newsier things that happened is that the Nets fired Jock Vaughn as their head coach. He had taken over for Steve Nash early last season, had his interim tag removed about a year ago, got a 4-year contract extension, and did not see out the full first year of it. Finishes with a 71-68 record across 3 seasons in Brooklyn, including a stint as Kenny Atkinson's interim when Kenny Atkinson got fired. One playoff appearance, which was a 4-game sweep at the hands of the Sixers that I watched up close, and it was dreadful. But the main issue here, though, is that they went into the break at 21-33, out of the final play-in spot in the East, and they got like absolutely drilled by 50 points by the Celtics in their last game. The Celtics didn't have Jaylen Brown or Al Horford. They barely played most of their main guys, and they got destroyed. So just generally, Patrick, what was your first reaction when you heard that Jock Vaughn was on the way out in Brooklyn?
It's just kind of remarkable that, you know, the Nets post KG and Pierce blow up were in this just total hole, no draft picks, no real talent. And they managed to claw their way out of that way quicker than I think a lot of people expected, only to sign, you know, 3 Hall of Famers and then end up in kind of the same place again now.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to speed run, you know, into, out of, and back into just total irrelevant. I mean, they're not totally irrelevant, but
It's just wild that they are in.
They can see it from here. If they're not there, it's on the horizon, and the horizon is getting closer.
Yeah, I think if you were to sort of handicap who has the bleakest medium term future in the NBA, it might be the Nets. I mean, everyone wants Mikal Bridges. At some point, Ben Simmons might score more than, you know, a hearty 999 triple single. But there's not a lot to like there. They have a lot of picks coming in that figure to be worse than their own picks, which are going out. And it's also kind of remarkable to see this, like a devolution like this, come down to a single ignominious loss, that Bucks one where they rested other guys after playing like 2 minutes in the first quarter.
Yeah, that Sean Marks was very clear in the post-firing, you know, elevation of Kevin Ollie to interim head coach press conference, saying like, I don't think we lost the season that day. I don't think we lost the guys that day. And then you go back and you look at like the actual quote from Mikal Bridges. You're absolutely right. Mikal Bridges plays the first quarter of that game largely to keep his like consecutive games Iron Man streak going, and then does not play after the first quarter of that game on December 27th. They sat Spencer Dinwiddie, Dorian Finney-Smith, Nick Claxton, and Cam Johnson. And the argument was second night of a back-to-back, fifth game in 7 nights. There was travel in there. Like, guys are, you know, redlining and we got to give them a rest. Mikal Bridges after the game just says, quote, didn't like the choice and whatever that was, but it's whatever. Definitely not a fan. And then since that game, they've gone 6-18 with like the 25th ranked offense in the league. And as you mentioned, they like circling the drain off in terms of their standings, and the worse they get, the better the pick they hand the Houston Rockets is. So like, there's just not a lot of fun to be had there. Especially the part where, and like, it's become kind of a hobby horse or an easy thing to beat the Nets up about, like, the arena is kind of, you know, there's a funereal vibe in the arena, like visiting teams fans routinely out cheer the Nets fans. When the Knicks play there, it's basically a second home game. And that now seems to extend to like Kyrie coming back from Dallas, or the Warriors coming into town, or anyone famous coming in to play at Barclays Center. It's kind of like an auxiliary home game in the way that people would talk about Atlanta being that kind of atmosphere too. But you sort of stack all these things up and it's like, well, what is there to be excited about? And to your point, yeah, like the medium range future here is like, what can we get theoretically if we don't want to trade Mikal Bridges, which is, as you mentioned, everyone wants, and there appears to be large numbers of offers on the table, including maybe down the line, like his buddies from Villanova that all play in New York now. but if not that, it's like, well, our like-sized guys, you know, Dorian Finney-Smith or Royce O'Neal's out the door, but you know, they have, you know, other wings that can shoot and do stuff. And Cam Thomas as like the inveterate gunner. That's a wonderful watch that like appears to be extremely divisive among NBA people. What does it all amount to? And I think it's really fascinating that what's coming now, Kevin Ollie comes in, respected NBA vet, like a dozen teams over a 13-year career, won the national title at UConn, coached at an overtime elite where the Thompson twins were coming up, all that kind of stuff. And his big thing was talking about, quote, energy generating behaviors, which I love just as a phrase and as a coaching point, quote, I got something called EGBs, which is energy generating behaviors. And it's 17 behaviors of those things. And we went through the list extensively today. They have nothing to do with talent, but everything to do with heart and will. And I think that's what it comes down to. And I guess that's just the kind of thing that you have to sell, much like Jacques Vaughn did. Like, we have to play harder than everybody because we don't have as much talent as everybody. But if you brand it, maybe that gives you a little bit longer of a runway. Like, I'm interested to find out all 17 energy generating behaviors. I wonder if there's going to be sort of rubrics for who is generating energy more effectively than others. Like, maybe someone surprises you and it's like, well, actually Noah Clowney is an EGB legend. Like, who knows what the advanced stats or the advanced metrics are on that. I don't know. What as you see, you talk the medium term future. In the short term future, what do you see for Brooklyn over the next 27, 28 games, whatever?
They're just going to have to decide, basically how bad they're willing to be and how quickly they're willing to be bad. Because I mean, I guess the reason you don't trade Bridges is because you think that you can convince free agents to maybe want to come play with him. I know like the Donovan Mitchell situation is still sort of unresolved, and you know, Bridges is a good fit alongside anyone.
Yeah.
Which is why everyone wants to trade for him. I just think like, you know, if you're talking about if you're doing three-letter acronyms and talking about energy generating behaviors and sort of generally carrying yourself like a lower tier West Coast conference coach. Maybe the vibes will get good at some point. Like, we haven't really seen Dariq Whitehead. I know he came into the year with some injury stuff, and they do have a lot of young guys, unclear how good they are. I'm just excited to watch Cam Thomas take 25 of the worst shots you've ever seen every game and somehow hit like 17 of them in a game or two. You know, will he go for 60? Will they lose by 50 in that game? Probably.
Well, that's the amazing thing where it's like, man, we got to find some structure and some form on offense. It's like, no, you don't, because the ball is going to find, whatever behaviors generate energy, the ball will find him where it needs to go. And then it might not go anywhere from there, but it's going to go at the hoop. And, you know, some nights that'll be a 50-point game and some nights it won't. But that, if nothing else, that's maybe something to keep an eye on for them down the stretch. Like, if Cam Thomas is on your fantasy team, I think buy some stock. You know, you're in a you might be in a good position going forward. Maybe not in the other categories, unless they, I guess, maybe they add energy generating behaviors to like your standard 12 category league or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have to consider the thermodynamics here, right? Because the ball finds energy, and if you can generate that, then you can basically just generate the ball. And the ball don't lie / is life. And you can kind of just see how this is like a self-sustaining kind of perpetual motion machine style offense he's installing, which I think like there's a lot going here.
Did Kevin Ollie just reach fusion? Is that what happened? Like, did we find a clean renewable energy source with these behaviors?
And it's Ben Simmons. Yeah.
Right. Well, I don't. Well, I guess it very much remains to be seen what kind of energy Ben Simmons generates over the next, you know, couple of months. But, you know, hope springs eternal, I suppose, for that. Speaking of hope and of joy and of these things, here's more compliments for the sandwich. We're going to stuff it like Permantes. I really enjoy your writing because of I love the way you turn a phrase. I want to highlight two recently that I loved. You recently described Chet Holmgren and Victor Wembanyama as Bucatini aliens. And back when the Bucks hired Doc Rivers, you described Damian Lillard's point of attack defense as a rusty combination lock compared to Drew Holiday's bank vault. That's just good stuff. And I want to make sure I'm highlighting that, because if people want to know why they should be forking over their money, it's for good stuff like that. But another aspect of it that I enjoy is, and this is pretty obvious and basic, it's evident that you like how cool basketball can look and finding fun ways to talk about the way it can look cool. So, at the risk of cribbing from my other show, Divine Intervention, where we talk more about feelings, what's, you know, give me something that has like brought you joy this season that you're like, I enjoyed watching this player, this team, this idea, whatever, like aesthetically just sort of made you happier.
The Thunder. I mean, everyone loves the Thunder. I love the Thunder. They're my favorite team to watch. And I think, there's just so much to like about them. The thing that I keep thinking about is the way that they kind of don't play like basically any other team in the league, which is sort of a function of how they play and then who they play more than anything. I mean, you know, Gordon Hayward is going to make his debut tonight, but they go, you know, 12 or 13 deep with like real actual NBA players. And the outlay of that is that they can throw all these like really strange, weird looks at you where it's like, you know, we have tall Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren and Kenrich Williams on the floor at the same time. Like, that's weird. And then we have like the Lou Dort, Cason Wallace, just all ball handler hell lineup. And that's weird. And, you know, everyone on the team is just like this shiny eyed zoomer. They're like all so fun. And I think there's kind of this pervading sense that when this gets to the playoffs, it's going to get real. And they're going to find out that the game is different. The game is more physical. I mean, Clippers Thunder, I think, which is happening on Thursday, is like the most enticing possible second round matchup, because it's the oldest team and the youngest team in the league. And the kind of thesis I've been thinking about is the game different enough in the playoffs to the point that the Thunder will have to become normal? And is that even possible for them? And I don't think so. Like, I think Daigneault's a good enough coach, and I think everyone is energetic. There's that word again. And confident enough that they can just kind of play Thunderball, and I think they can win the finals. Maybe that's nuts.
Well, it's maybe aggressive, but I don't think it's crazy. And I think it's interesting. I love the way that you framed that. Because they play five out, which like everybody does now, or so many teams do or aspire to, but you're right. They do it with weird pieces. It's like, if you're playing with action figures that come from different, like, different IP lines or whatever. And you're like, but we're going to make them play in that story. This guy is going to go into this world and he's not supposed to be there, where the guards are so physical that they sort of wind up resolving a lot of the big responsibilities. Like, I would feel as comfortable with Lou Dort boxing somebody out as I would with Chet Holmgren doing it, right? Or like Jalen Williams being like 6'5", but also like 6'5" thick, like wide enough that he's like, I'm totally comfortable with him guarding fours. And
he's
so
subtly cubic.
The pieces, there's so many that mix and match. Yes, exactly. Right. I like that.
Sorry.
It's a square footage type situation. No, by all means. And so they've already had like that initial taste of were in the play-in last year. They win a game, they lose a game. So there's a general, introduction of what it means when it gets more intense. But stylistic, like they are a top five offense and a top five defense that has been able to play really big and small, but still kind of physical all around it. I don't think it's nuts to say that they can make a deep playoff run depending on how the seedings work out. I also think like looking at it and saying, or my former colleague, I know a friend of yours, Eric Freeman from Ball Don't Lie, when we would talk years ago about the initial iteration of the Thunder, he was like, a lot of teams have two guys that can guard guys like that, but nobody's got three. And obviously the guys differ, but SGA, Chet, and Jalen Williams, it's like, at some point late in the game, and we've seen it a ton from Oklahoma City this season, SGA is an MVP candidate, maybe like one of the two or three favorites at this point. And he's setting a screen, throwing the ball to Jay Will and saying like, or Jay Dub rather, and saying, go get it. Like, I trust that you're going to do it. And Jalen Williams has been an amazing crunch time scorer and playmaker in that regard too. So at a certain point, yeah, maybe they're too young for it, but also like, do you got three that can guard guys like that? I don't know that you do.
Yeah. They're not scared of anyone either. And the way they play five out, where it's just like they use the space, like they drive as well as any team in the league. I mean, Shea famously is just so good at driving. And is J Dub the little one? I mean, little. Is he the shorter Jalen Williams? Yeah.
Yes. J Dub is Santa Clara. J Will is big, just tall J Will.
And there's a third Jalen Williams who plays for Auburn, who I don't think is going to get drafted, but Sam Presti, please. Please.
Yeah, just for the sake of it. I mean, between that and then there being like Nikola Jokic, Nikola Jovic, and Nikola Topic. I'm like, there's sort of a, it's the simulate. Like when you get to a certain level of, NCAA football, and it's like the auto-generated names are just kind of like all cycling through one another. And you got Bobson Dugnut and, Todd Gonzalez or whatever coming through. Like that sort of feels like where we are right now. But I'm sorry, go ahead. The way they play five out.
I'm just really glad they didn't trade for another big. I think a lot of the, yes. Famously they have so much trade ammo, and they did make a trade. And I really liked Micić, but I think, Hayward can probably contribute, but I'm glad they didn't compromise the way that they play and play around Chet specifically, because he's not like a good rebounder yet. And like you said, the guards can contribute, but it was Pat Riley who said rebounds get rings or something like that. And like, that's the thing that I sort of worry about them in the playoffs, but they're going to be so nasty on defense too. Like Cason Wallace he's the real deal. He's so good. And him, when you have him and Dort together, it's kind of, maybe this is borderline sacrilegious, but it's kind of Celtics-y in that, like, okay, you run, a small screen or something, and then all of a sudden you have like the different lockdown defender guy instead of the one who was guarding you initially. And it's still, tough sledding, and just Chet's rim protection too, I just find so impressive. I don't know. They're just so fun. And they only, tonight against the Clippers is their last time they have to play a fellow top four team for the rest of the season. So, the standings race is just so wild up there. It's so close, and they have the edge on these other three schedule wise. And I mean, home court is going to matter a lot. Like OKC is a hard building to play in, but then like, so is Denver. And so if you can get four home games in that potential series, like that really matters.
Yeah. It boils down, well, first off, that scheduling note is fantastic. That's very, very good. I wish I had paid attention to that and looked at it when I wrote my big thing this morning about like storylines to watch in seeding races, which you can read at Yahoo Sports, but it won't include good that blog note. You can only get that here on the audio format. But if so much of it, at the risk of oversimplifying, so much of it boils down to like, can we create more advantages against you than you can create against us? And the way they defend across positions and the way that they like the multiple ball handlers and shooters, the way that team has entirely like en masse leveled up shooting wise, shouts out to Chip Englund, I guess, has made everybody an advantage, either someone who can create an advantage or extend one. And they erase them on the other end. Yeah, I think it'll be fascinating to watch how the matchups shake out, but I do not think that your faith in them is unfounded. And I also don't think, whether they, win one series or three series or whatever, the joy of watching them has been one of the coolest things this season. Like, progress isn't linear, but they're like, their arrow has just continued to point up, which is rad as hell.
The last like way they play note, their best passer is probably either Josh Giddey, who mostly just can do it from like a pure standstill, but is great at it, or J Dub. But their collective passing of that team, I think, is as good as any yes. in the league. Just like, they only draft guys who can pass. Like, Chet's sauce as a passer is like the thing that surprised me most this season. And I just love that, like, anyone who steps on the floor can make that, like, you know, get a little advantage, kick it out, and then Isaiah Joe has an open three, two passes later. And just as a collective, they're so good at that. And I love watching it.
It's a wonderful thing to watch, and something we're going to come back to probably in a little bit when we talk about some more post All-Star storylines. But we're going to start out in the East for that kind of chunk of the schedule here. So I'm interested, you know, we talked about the Thunder and that West race up at the top. What is something in the East that you are going to be sort of keeping an eye on, that you're interested in down the stretch here?
Who's going to make the conference finals, presumably against the Celtics? That whole bolus of teams there is just so interesting. The Cavs are just kicking everyone out of their gym. They look so good right now. And I know you're a big Knicks person, and
I am.
When they were healthy, I was having some borderline heretical thoughts of, can this team make the finals? Are they just going to beat the crap out of everyone they play, including Boston? And now everyone's hurt. Julius Randle's shoulder is full of crab meat. It's just kind of a bad situation.
Which, as we have established on across shows on this network, is my fault. I enjoyed what I was watching too much. I briefly felt hope and love in my heart. And the gods, or maybe just like the Judeo-Christian God, I don't know, struck me down. And so that's what's happening now with the crab meat shoulders and the various elbow loose bodies. So, but yes, sorry, continue.
No, but in the same way that the Thunder play this like very harmonious basketball, the Knicks also play harmonious basketball, in the sense that anyone who steps on the floor is just like made out of concrete and will just fight you for 48 minutes. And I love watching the Tibbsian coherence that they have going there, and the fact that Dante will just shoot 16 threes in a game and make four and still be totally impactful. And I mean, there's a lot of talk about rebounding on this show, but Josh Hart is my favorite guy under 6'5" to watch rebound. He's just so, so nasty with it. And it's just such a shame they're not healthy right now, because of all of that, like, big chunk of teams in the middle, the top end of the middle of the East, they're my favorite to watch. I mean, interesting to see what will happen with Embiid here. That was a good note in your blog this morning about how he could file a little protest thing through the union to say, hey, I played 45 games, but, you know, you guys all saw what I was doing. Please vote for me, which he obviously won't do, but it's funny to imagine.
You can submit the paperwork and say, like, there are two kinds of grievances. So this is super fun stuff, reading the CBA, but like, the section of the CBA that governs this, you know, the 65 game minimum for consideration for major awards includes a couple of pathways for like loopholes and workarounds. One of them is like, if your team is actively holding you out, like if you are willing to sort of go up against City Hall and say they're holding me back. And then the other one is like, if they were extenuating circumstances that prevented you, like, so say you, it was like, I'm at 64, but then on the night of the 65th game, a sinkhole opens up, or like the DeAndre Ayton, it's icy. Yeah, it's icy up on my hill. Then, you know, maybe, you know, an independent arbitrator would look kindly on you. I doubt it's going to happen for Embiid, but it would be really funny to see him just like submit the paperwork and say, come on, like, you saw, you know how good.
Or for Cam Thomas to make the case that Jock Vaughn was holding me back. He was bringing me off the bench, and I'm the realest hooper. And if you squint your eyes in this really weird way, maybe you could make the case that my per 36, yada, yada, yada. You know, he's the kind of guy I think who would do that. And I would vote for him.
It requires a certain level of audacity. And we know that that's not something that Cam Thomas lacks. So I like that. I agree with you that like, who's the, in that sort of second tier of the East, who is the most likely to mount a serious challenge to the Celtics. It brings me no pleasure to say that the Celtics are six games clear of the rest of the pack in the East and have looked like a wrecking crew for most of the season. They cooled off a little bit in January and then went on an absolute heater getting into the All-Star break, capped by that 50-point demolition of the Nets. They have earned their status as, you know, the favorite heading in. the one in that group, I mean, you mentioned the Knicks, and they're one that I'm fascinated to find out when Randall, OG Anunoby, Mitchell Robinson, who we thought was going to be out for the season, but now might be back like in a few weeks. You know, when all those guys get healthy and what they look like from there. The team that in that group, though, that I'm like, I am most curious about is like, so what are you, Bucks? Like, are you the team that is like, you've got the point differential of a 46 win team and like is bad at defense and then bad at offense and not really good at either at any given time? Or are you like the 35-21 team with an MVP candidate and like an all NBA, you know, flamethrower and a coach who's been there before, which take it or, you know, whatever. And the Bucks themselves seem, if not ill-prepared, maybe like unwilling to offer clarity on that matter. Doc Rivers is out there publicly being like, I literally don't understand why they hired me. I'm flummoxed by this whole development. Giannis is giving quotes where he's like, it's Dame's team. I'm riding with Dame. Like, shouts out to my guy, Eric Name at The Athletic, getting like a, I don't know how many F-bombs there are in that article. It's, you know, if you control F for it, there's a lot of them. And like, they're awesome when they've got their main guys on the floor. Chris Middleton is like a huge X factor because he often is in and out of the lineup, now dealing with an ankle injury. They don't have point of attack defenders. They don't have like a reliable fifth guy most nights. And yet, I don't know. So yeah, I guess where are you on the Bucks? When you look at them, what do you see?
I think they need Middleton to be like all caps Chris Middleton to really be anything. Yeah. Because like watching them play, they had a national TV game in Phoenix. And in that game, watching Dame just try and fail to chase Booker around screens. And then watching just kind of the late era campaign experience, you just watch them, you think like, how does this team ever score the basketball or stop the other team from scoring if Giannis isn't just like given a nice big runway? It's just like very clunky on both ends. There's not a lot of flow, but then like you said, when they're on, it's just these two huge 7-footers protecting the rim. It's open shots galore. And I think it's weird to see this big a level of variance because they were so reliable for so long because Giannis was just Giannis. And I think Middleton is just that good steadying presence. He's like the one guy on that team who can be normal on both ends of the court in like very critical ways. And so like you said, can they put together like a good 15 game stretch where they're good on both ends? Because we know what their level is. We've seen their level on each side of the court, just never at the same time. And while potential is great, you know, we're 60 or something games into the season, they kind of just have to do it. And I guess they know they can go into any of those series knowing they have the best player, which is something. And yet I worry about Dame in the playoffs, but like also the reason they got him is for the playoffs where you just need a guy who can take 25 shots. And so I think they could still win the East. It could be weird, but there's, I don't know, Beverly weirdly is like a helpful player for them.
The amount of actual on-court Patrick Beverly relevance is not something that I was prepared for back in like mid or early October. That like he was legitimately good for the Sixers, even though like when you look at his shooting percentages and stuff, you're like, I must have only seen the shots Pat Bev made and like not the 95 other ones that he missed. But like he's out there driving and throwing up hooks. He's like doing all sorts of helpful stuff for the Sixers. And then, yeah, just like if as a legitimately decent point of attack defender, even at, you know, this deep into his career. And then also just like an attitude adjustment for a team that kind of needs something to kick it in the ass. I kind of like I like that as a move for them. But to your point, or the thing that I think is really interesting, like, yes, Chris Middleton. Like we have, I think, broadly coalesced around the idea that Chris Middleton is like the big swing factor for the Bucks, in part because we've established as givens that Giannis and Dame are going to be there. And what this blog presupposes is maybe Dame won't be there. Like Dame's shooting 29% from three since January 1st. He had a really rocky start and you forgave it and you understood it because it was like learning how to play in this new system, learning how to, there's more different things that are being asked of me on offense and on defense. There's so much more comfort and so many more reps that Giannis has with Chris Middleton. I've kind of got to get in where I fit in. And everyone's saying be more aggressive, but I also kind of want to let it come to me and figure it out on my own. And then like that starts to warm up and he starts, you know, hitting a ton of shots and he's playing really well, like through, you know, the, you know, late November to December. And then it's kind of fallen off a cliff again. And so like if Dame isn't an all NBA shot creator and maker, then you traded Drew Holiday and you moved off Grayson Allen and you kind of did whatever for not that significant of an offensive upgrade. And that's disastrous. And I think that there's reason to believe in Damian Lillard, but it's also kind of interesting that a guy who is as decorated and as venerated and as like deep into his career as Dame is now kind of a pretty big question mark in terms of where this team can go, as opposed to, you know, like the exclamation point I think everybody expected him to be.
That's so true. And Grayson Allen, by the way, leading the NBA in 3-point percentage right now. Yeah, that's such a good point. And, you know, his sort of the slight degradation of his ability to get to the rim, I think, is like a big sort of issue here. Like the Bucks spacing is a little weirder than most teams, but he's not quite, you know, in that late, like last year in Portland, I feel like he was getting, you know, 12 free throws a game. It was so reliable at getting to the rim, and just that little lack of pop, or just the, you know, like you said, the different system could be that. And yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see if he can really reclaim that form, because I think it's in there. You know, he was so good last year, and there will be adjustments. And this idea that they need to run more, you know, Giannis Dame straight up bread and butter pick and roll, like we've talked about that a lot. Like Giannis doesn't like setting screens. The inverted version of that is like way more intriguing to me, because you know, you can get Dame popping and stuff. I think I'm sort of a Doc apologist as a coach.
Talk to me about why, because I feel like people talk so much about what Doc is and isn't, and it feels like we're all sort of talking past each other. What where do you land on the Doc Rivers evaluation?
So Bomani Jones made this point yesterday, and Doc's teams never quit on him. They choke a lot, but that's different than quitting. Right. And I think you could point to, okay, last year with the Sixers, did they quit on him in that game 7? And I think that like the game 6 loss, when they just scored like 12 points in the fourth quarter or something at home, like that's the flaw with Doc's game plans and stuff, is he's not like the most nuanced tactician, but guys always play hard for him. And I guess the Giannis name interview maybe is a counterpoint to this, but I feel like he's good at managing star egos and getting like sort of complicated pieces to fit chemistry wise together. And I guess the larger order take here is that coaching only matters to a certain degree, and ultimately it's the players that do the thing, and he puts the players in the best headspace to succeed. Perhaps that's undercut by all the 3-1 leads that his teams have blown, but I just sort of feel like he gives you a baseline of reliability, and he won't on his own screw things up. And the thing about the Redick, the JJ Redick rant, is like Doc has been fired for the right reasons 3 times, which to me is being held accountable for his team's failures. Like there's a long record of that. And I just think he does a pretty good job of putting people in the right positions, just not always in the highest leverage moments.
A completely fair read on it. I think Doc does himself no favors by how frequently he, after the fact, leaves tread marks on his star players' backs or on someone else's, you know, like putting the gun in somebody else's hand always, and saying like, that's the reason things sort of fell apart, as opposed to any failing that I might have had. But you're absolutely right. Like, generally speaking, the degree to which the coach of the Milwaukee Bucks matters, matters because it gets Giannis Antetokounmpo like fully on board and doing like engaged. And in that interview with Eric Name, Giannis says like, Griff was doing a great job, but also he's won 30 games and Doc has won like 1,100. And I feel like, and so if that is something he feels more comfortable with and more confident in and engages the full buy-in from him. And as you mentioned, Giannis is playing maybe the best basketball he has ever played in a career that has already seen 2 MVPs and a finals MVP and, you know, whatever else, then that is what gives you, you know, the hope and the puncher's chance, you know, over and above anything else. We're going to go to break in a minute, but before we do, I want to know, is there another thing in the East that you are particularly keen on heading down the stretch here?
I don't really think you can make a case for them winning a playoff series, but I really like how the Magic play, and I'm excited for them to make the playoffs, just because I want to see Paolo kind of have a moment. I want to see Jalen Suggs and Franz and all those guys get some experience. Right now, they're the 8 seed. Magic Boston would be a real, I mean, they played Boston pretty tough this year, but that would be a pretty rude awakening for them. But just like, I'm excited for them. I really like watching that team, and I hope they can win a game or two on their home court and really, you know, go into next year thinking like, okay, that's what it's like. We can do this. Let's go get the four seed.
There's also sort of like an ancestral power of Magic as 8 seed going into, or 7 seed going into higher seeded opponent's gym, taking game one and then, you know, moving out of the way. My former coworker, Kevin Clark at The Ringer, when I interviewed DJ Augustine, was like, ask him what it's like to own Toronto, because he made a game winner against the Raptors once. And then that was it. And it's also the Magic as a, it, where they are in their building process, that's a fascinating little, you know, bit of where the East can go. They've got tentpole guys up front. They feel super confident, obviously, and justifiably so. And Paolo Banchero just made his first All-Star game. Franz Wagner has been, you know, arguably even more important sometimes for what they do offensively and the versatility they can have in their front court. And then, like, the truth serum here is going to be which of these guards plays in the playoffs, which of these guards do you trust in the playoffs, and which would you feel confident building around long term? And so, like, there are, you know, pros and cons, you know, benefits and demerits to all of Jalen Suggs, Cole Anthony, Markel Fultz, you know, Anthony Black, you know, Gary Harris, whatever, you know, the whole sort of crew of fine, but not exactly what you necessarily want to build around guards, or like not the no doubt about it guy that balances out your bigs. So getting to see what they look like against a, you know, brutal defense like the Celtics, or again, you know, dealing with an offense that can stretch you out and can, you know, just pick and pat, you know, pick you apart in so many different ways, would be instructive, would be clarifying. And also, I mean, they're only whatever it is, like a half game or a game and a half out of being out of the play-in in general. Like, it's possible based on how injuries shake out and, you know, the that middle class of the East evolves, they could get up to six. They could get out of that, you know, those really gnarlier opening matchups. And then, you know, if you're in a 3-6 and you've got a scattershot Bucks or a Knicks team that is still dealing with injuries, like the fact that Julius Randle, they have not ruled out shoulder surgery is something to be notable and or to be to note and be concerned about, perhaps. A team that is just going to like drag you into the mud and make it a knife fight, and like every possession is going to be at a premium. You know, weird things can happen in series like that. And the Magic seem like a team that's capable of making weird things happen.
Yeah. And they'll play those weird bench lineups with Ingles and Cole Anthony and like Mo Wagner just running around flopping 4 times a play, somehow grabbing some of the nastiest offensive rebounds you've ever seen. And you just think like, this would be so, so, so annoying to play against, but man, yes, it's working. And if they can just kind of, you know, I can see a version of, you know, the Patrick Beverley Bucks bench just all of a sudden giving up like a 12-2 run out of nowhere because Ingles hits 2 threes and then Wagner just goes nuts. And I'm really excited for them to have that moment.
And in that dynamic, really an underrated and a lower key ghost of Doc Rivers' past. In terms of an opening round playoff matchup with the Magic, and you know, maybe counting your chickens before they're hatched in terms of which, you know, which team is going to advance, much to be paying attention to there. We are going to take a quick break to pay some bills, and we will be right back to talk about more post All-Star storylines here on No Cap Room. Welcome back to No Cap Room. I'm here with Patrick Redford of Defector, and we are talking through some of the post-All-Star break NBA storylines we're going to be talking about. We just hit the Eastern Conference, some of the things that we're focusing on there. We will turn attention to the West. And Patrick, I know that you are a self-described Sacramento Kings sicko. Where you are on the Kings at this point and sort of where they lie in the landscape. Is that something you're going to be paying particular attention to down the stretch here?
Unfortunately, yes. I'm kind of like one of those old ship captains married to the sea on this one. This has been a really strange, frustrating Sacramento Kings season. They came into the All-Star break after beating the coming back from 16 down to beat the Nuggets in Denver off a total De'Aaron Fox masterclass. 2 games earlier, they lost by double digits to the Pistons at home. They've dropped games to the Hornets on the second night of a back-to-back without any of their guys at home. They lost to Portland. They've also beaten the Thunder twice, the Wolves, the Nuggets twice. Kind of a weird season for them. they famously came into the year going continuity mode. They made eyes at Kyle Kuzma. Thankfully, he did not come in for the big bag of money they were offering him. And they've kind of been the same team they were last year. The problem is everyone in the West is healthy instead of all torn up and full of holes. And so, you know, they're playing essentially the same quality of basketball with the same guys. They're just in the eight spot right now and not the three, which kind of has nothing to do with them. And I know fans are very frustrated because that's five spots lower. They came into the trade deadline and thankfully did not make any moves because no one wants Harrison Barnes, and Kevin Huerter is finally playing a little productive basketball. As a fan, I just want them to make the playoffs. I don't really have any grand illusions about, you made the first round last year, you have to make the second round this year. You know, I don't really expect them to be able to beat the Wolves or the Clippers or anyone like that in the first round. It's just been fun. I've really liked De'Aaron Fox this year. He's been pretty inconsistent, however. Like, the three-point shot really came along, then it totally abandoned him. And I think ultimately where I'm at is that this is a pretty fun, dangerous team that will win, if we're lucky, two games in a kind of not competitive six-game series. But if I had to make an actual prediction, they lose to the Mavs in the first play-in game, then lose by 9,000 to the Warriors in the second play-in game.
That is heartrending. That's a truly bleak outcome here. I mean, it's certainly within the realm of possibilities. It's on the spectrum there, but I think they are among a group that's sort of tightly clustered in that like 5 to 8 range. I guess if you wanted to throw the Lakers at 9 in because they're only a couple games back of it, but like a game and a half separating four teams, and like qualitatively, I guess when you look at, Phoenix, New Orleans right now tied at 33-22, 5-6 in the West, Dallas right underneath them, and then the Kings right underneath them, only a half game behind. I guess you would say, like, qualitatively, all three of those teams above them have the more, like, the higher end talent, right? You would say that whether it's Booker and Durant, Beal, obviously sort of a big question mark in Phoenix, but Zion and Brandon Ingram when they're on and going in New Orleans, and then obviously Luka and then Kyrie in Dallas. Like, you would say if you had to like go with your NBA Jam lineup, so your top two guys, you might take them over Fox and Domantas Sabonis, the subject of a wonderful piece that Patrick wrote recently on rebounding that I heartily suggest people check out. I know more rebounding talk. This is what the people crave. But I do wonder, like, we did see this Kings team hold up reasonably well in the hothouse of a really tough, really physical, really emotional first round series last year. So it's not like if they are playing roughly commensurate basketball, if they are roughly a commensurate talent level team, this is not the first go around now for Keegan Murray, who has also continued to improve and just like, and validated the faith that front office and coaching staff has had in him. It would not shock me for that Kings team to similarly hold up really well in a first round series against a team that you might be more experienced or might have more top end talent, but might not be able to rely on that level of continuity or whatever. So, I mean, and I can buy Fox in, can you top this game against most of those guys. Like, it doesn't feel crazy to me. I look at the Kings and I say, like, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily buy a deep run, but I don't think that they're like orders of magnitude worse than those other teams in that cluster.
That's sort of relieving to hear. I think I sort of have 16 years of caked on accreted Kings anxiety that's speaking more than my eyes here. And like, now that Harrison Barnes has regained the use of his limbs, that really like
critical
really solves a lot of problems, because that team is just so shallow on the wing. And Murray's defense has been like really nasty this year. Like, that's one of the biggest improvements of any player on the team. The problem is he kind of isn't shooting that well, and the self-creation stuff, which he really flashed earlier in the season, isn't totally popping. But the version of the Kings where he's, scoring 25 and grabbing 12 rebounds and just kind of filling in every gap around Fox and Sabonis, you see that and you're like, this is a real team that, would scare the crap out of anyone. I think the issue they have is that if you can effectively shut off Sabonis's creation And we saw this in when they blew a heinous 22 or 23 point lead in the fourth quarter to the Suns. The Suns went Durant at center and just pressed up into Sabonis and just took away the DHO stuff. And then all of a sudden, they're spending 18 seconds of every possession trying and failing to get, you know, Kevin Huerter an advantage in the perimeter. And then it's, okay, Malik, just go do something nuts. And I think when the team is at their best, it's just Malik, Monk, and Fox just playing off of each other. They're so good at relocating after little picks and rolls and stuff. And I like, again, in the Warriors series last year, that game six win in San Francisco, that was just, you know, going five out, going tiny. And I think Sabonis learned a lot from those failures last year, but I still kind of can't shake the feeling that they're not quite physical enough aside from him, or and they're a little small. They have some big athletes, but they can get overwhelmed. Like the Clippers are a total poison matchup for them. And I just kind of don't see a path to them winning a series.
Well, I appreciate the clear-eyed, but perhaps jaundiced view. I know. I mean, but listen, it's fair. Because as you know, as you've mentioned here, like we are talking about like that top eight is awfully strong. Like there are teams that were in the midst of a down run last season. You know, obviously the Thunder, this year's Thunder are not last year's Thunder. The Nuggets are still very much there. As long as they have Nikola Jokic, they will be there. And they have been an elite team when they've had their starting five healthy. I think even when it's like, you look at, you slice up the lineup data and it's like, as long as they've had, I think it's Jokic, Jamal Murray, and Michael Porter Jr., they're at like a 60 or 61 win pace when they've had those guys available. And Porter is probably not even the third most important guy on the team because Aaron Gordon has been the guy who unlocks so much of what Denver can do. And that's like, you know, my hobby horse with the Kings is also like, find me Sabonis's Aaron Gordon. Like, where's the big four who can provide some more of that physicality on the, you know, the big wing guy? And there was a moment where I was like, well, maybe Jeremy Grant can be that for them, or, you know, like insert guy here. And it's where, you know, as you said, they were looking at, they looked at Kuzma. They're kind of like, is that enough of an upgrade for what we need? And they decided against it, or Kuzma decided against it, or whatever. I think that's the idea for them moving forward. But it's just, there are so many of these teams that have a story they can tell themselves and really believe this is how it unfolds for us and where we get there. And the one of those we haven't really hit on too much in the Western conversation that I'm interested in, or that I'm among the most interested in, is the Wolves. Because it feels like you have to see it to believe it, right? Like it just, we saw that it was so wobbly at the end, you know, for most of last year. And then at the end of last year, and you've got guys punching other guys and walls, and they hold up pretty well against Denver in round one, but you know,
it was
that's
a
round
pretty
one
competitive five game series. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And you know, that's there, you know, they were complimented for that, and then come in this season. And it was like everybody who had the take that Gobert makes sense if you squint was just a year early. And now it looks the way that Tim Connelly thought it would on the box. And yet you still look at it and go like, for real? Like it's going to be, we're buying this collection of guys in a playoff series. And I'm willing to be the cockeyed optimist on them and say like, I think it does work. I think it can work, because I think if the formula is we're huge everywhere on defense, and when things break down, it's Ant or Cat to create something. I can see that. I can absolutely see that working in a playoff series. But I'm wondering, does that seem tenable to you, a series, two series, whatever, deep? Or do you feel like the Wolves are about to kind of have a cold splash of water and reality in their face?
It totally makes sense to me. I think I'm as much of a Wolves hater as exists, but I really have to say, like, McDaniels is just, he's unbelievable on defense. And having that, like, bedrock reliability, I think, gives them such a high floor. And I forget who's making this point, but there's obviously the notion that Rudy Gobert could get played off the floor in the playoffs. It happened before against the Clippers, who they could face in the second round. And someone was making the point that he was playing with bad point of attack defenders. So he was spending all of his time putting out fires and being called in to do things he didn't have to do. If you have not Donovan Mitchell, but just Edwards and McDaniels containing the ball, I mean, we're seeing what he's doing with the space he's getting this year. And on offense, you know, he's posting up more. He's getting the ball more. He dunked on Kawhi in that like amazing Wolves Clippers game.
Felt like and an exorcism. Yeah.
It's one of the nice all-star storylines was Conley's extension because I'm a big Conley guy, and it's, you know, started this new round of appreciation for just like, wow, he's so reliable. He's such a good passer. He makes this very odd team tick. And I don't know so much about their depth. I'm a big Naz Reid guy, but also like, he's the third best center on the team, and ultimately unclear how many playoff minutes he's going to get when Cat and Gobert are playing more. We do
I
have
hope
to
the
see
answer
it.
To that though is a ton because as just a like, let's make you play left-handed. The idea of them going gigantic in a series is like, you want to downshift and go small against us, we're going huge, deal with it. I kind of like that just from a, you know, we talk so much about teams play the same all the time. That would not be the same. That would be a dramatic thing to shift to watch, and then styles make fights.
And this is perhaps a sort of ethereal higher order point, but like there's a lot of chatter about how much of games is down to just 3-point shooting luck. You know, is it really determinative if you just kind of happen to go 15 for 36 as opposed to like 10 for 36? And I think the way to think about that is rhythm. And I think if you can disrupt a team's rhythm and force them to rely on shooting luck, you know, by going big, they go small, spread you out, whatever, you are like, you're in this scenario, the Wolves are the team doing this. You're grabbing the impetus. Like you are forcing the tempo and dictating the terms of the game. And I think there's some kind of unquantifiable benefit to just saying, this is what we're doing. This is like hard to deal with, you know, you, the Clippers or Suns in the first round, like try the KD at center stuff. Like you're about to find out what it's like to have a minus 16 rebounding deficit because we're just going to, you know, kick the shit out of you downstairs. And I love that they seem to have embraced their nastiness. Like I watched them, they came to Sacramento around Christmas time, and that was just a total beatdown. And the Kings, not to make a Kings point here, but like the Kings are a sort of useful bellwether in another team's physicality, because if you crank it up a notch, you can just blow them out of the gym. And Rudy Gobert was just styling on Domantas Sabonis down low, like with the ball in his hands in a way that I've never seen him do before. Like Cat is such a good passer specifically to Rudy. And they've realized you can get a lot of easy buckets by just giving it to the guy with an 8-foot wingspan down low. And like, there's been a lot of chatter about Ant's improvements as a playmaker. And something I kind of like about that is that he doesn't have to like, you know, beat a guy off a dribble and just throw some like LeBron level crazy pass out to the corner. He just needs to make the simple play more often. And he's doing that. And he probably will have to do less of that in the playoffs when it's, you know, time to go get 40 points. And I'm excited to watch him this year. That's the guy.
I think a lot of people are, because we've seen him look good. Like he was I'm ready for prime time moment in that Memphis series a couple of seasons ago, where it's like, oh, he's like, I'm taking Ja Morant out of this game and I'm going to be giving buckets on the other end of it. And like some, you know, hubristic mistakes from a young guy and whatever, but like you'd rather have sins of commission than omission for a guy at that level. And so, yeah, I'm interested in it. I think there's a lot to like there. Also, just like, as you mentioned, shouts out to Mike Conley. It seems not coincidental that like every version, the teams that he's been on, they reach their best versions of themselves with him being there. And maybe that's just like, I don't know if he's the giving tree or if he's like some, he was like a sage old turtle or whatever, but like they always seem to get better and reach their like best self with him being there, you know, with his hand on the dial.
You know why?
Why is that?
Energy generating behaviors.
Well, I can't ask for a better button than that, but I will say if you have one more thing that you want to highlight in the West, this would be the time to do so.
The Pelicans. Weird team. Those top three guys are so good, and it's sort of unclear if any of them make each other better. They have this great infrastructure around, like, basically around any possible star you'd want, like Dyson Daniels, Herb Jones, and Trey Murphy out there. Dyson can't really shoot, and he's kind of hurt, but like Herb Jones is shooting the hell out of it right now. Yep. All those guys are big, they can defend, and then they kind of have one version of the team where it's Ingram and CJ doing pick and roll stuff and hitting mid range. And then another where it's like, okay, Zion's going to drive. Oh, he's going left. Oh, he's shooting with his left at the rim. He just does the one thing, but he's, you know, amazing at it. But kind of like there's a lot of plays where it's just Ingram standing in the corner for five plays in a row, or like CJ is just kind of spotting up. And the way that they can help each other get better, I'm not really sure about, but also like that team is so good and so deep. And I totally think they could win a first round series against one of those top four. Like we haven't really seen Zion do it at that level. And also he doesn't really dunk as much anymore. So the athleticism is not quite there, but he's been so good lately. And I just think that team is so fascinating. And I don't really know what their ceiling is. I don't know if we've seen them. I mean, I guess when Zion was healthy last year and they were the one seed, that was like, you know, they showed us how good they can be. And I kind of want to see it. And I think they can unlock it.
That I will, I'd be, you know, like a guy pointing back at a picture of me. Like I used to, it was like this. I promise. It really was like this. What if that version of the Pelicans, the beginning of last year. And yet they are now like a, it feels like a team that's got like two or there's like too many, you know, too much jewelry on, needs to take one thing off kind of thing, where you're like, it's like they're a legitimate like 11 deep. And like, Cody Zeller is like what they're like 13th guy. And he was playing finals minutes for the Heat last year. Maybe more of a statement about the Heat, but generally like there's so many guys that you're like, yeah, I would love to see that guy in a big moment, or yeah, I would trust that guy when it matters. And, but so, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like it's, there's so many complementary pieces that are perfect, but you need the stake. You need the star in the middle. Like it can't be, you know, a lot of incredible side dishes, and where's the star of the dish? And Zion can be that guy. I believe, I mean, we saw in that first round series against Phoenix a couple of years ago, Ingram looked like that guy, but can they be that at the same time, you know, off of one another, is like one of the great as yet unanswered questions in the league. And they've kind of staked the structure of the team on it being so, or at least needing to find the answer to it. And I'm a believer in that collection of guys, and in that you can find the right five, that Willie Green can find the right five in the moments that matter.
And like Larry Nance is such a good center for them. He unlocks so much. He's just like, he always knows where to stand. He's a good, willing passer. They just make sense up to the most important questions. We've had a lot of Cam Thomas talk. Jordan Hawkins, I love that guy. He's so fun.
Yes.
He should be more nuts. He should be shooting worse shots more often. I honestly think it's better for the team.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like, especially when you get to a point where like variance might matter a lot, like, all right, we found our guy, we crank the knob up to 11 and rip it off. Like that's the guy. And if he can hold up defensively enough, give him the option to do that. Or even just like throw him out there and find out, right? Like I think the Pelicans, it's weird for a team that has this level of talent and, you know, some expectations, and it's sort of at this point in its development, there's still like a little bit of, we got to find out. And I am, I'm excited to find out with them. But they could find themselves in a position where like, instead of being in that, you know, four spot and, you know, looking at first round, or they're probably not going to get up to four, but like being in an advantageous situation in the first round, like you could wind up having a fight from underneath just because of the way that the other seating above you shakes out. And that's, you know, that would be a disappointing outcome, but I think that they would bring to bear enough talent and depth for that to be a real dogfight for any favorite in that kind of Western first round matchup.
They're seventh in defense, despite starting like CJ and Zion. Like, and I think so much of that is just like, they turn you over, they don't foul, and they rebound the hell out of it, thanks to Valanciunas. And, you know, Herb and Trey can really guard out there. I don't know if that is like the right kind of good defense to be in the playoffs, because you're pick-onable in a way that, like, you know, the Wolves or the Thunder really aren't, you know?
Yeah, well, just that there are... when you have the weak spots, people are going to seek and destroy in the context of a playoff series. And they're not, you know, amoebic or whatever, in the same way that someone like Boston or Minnesota can be. Although Minnesota does have Conley at the point of it. You know, like there are guys that you could pick at there. But yeah, I mean, the Pelicans have all sorts of dudes to throw out, and I look forward to seeing them thrown out. Sorry, one last thing. Just like, do we think that Denver is still the, you know, class of the West until proven otherwise?
I think their highest level is higher than anyone. Like that everyone talks about that game in Boston, which I think was legitimately transformative. And the thing we saw there was, and teams have defended Jokic more this way, where they just really try to turn off his water. And it's not so much make him into a scorer, but just force him to not, basically take away his space and force Jamal. It's you're ceding an advantage to Jamal and saying, you kind of have to beat us. And he did. And right. A lot of their recent losses, like, it's because Colin Gillespie was guarding De'Aaron Fox. Like, I don't take that game that seriously. And the backup center thing isn't a problem in the playoffs because Aaron Gordon's the backup center. And right. Talk about rebounders. Man, he is just unbelievably athletic. I love watching him play. And I think, like, KCP hasn't played in a while. They kind of have to get out of third gear at some point because home court really will matter here. Like,
absolutely.
They lost, I think, one game at home in the playoffs last year. That's just a hard building to play in. And if they can get the one or two seed, I would feel pretty confident about them making it out of the West, despite how fierce the competition is around them. I'm not worried about them, but like, I guess I am to the point that seeding matters.
It makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, that, and then the other question mark to some degree, like I'm not as worried about the second unit. Obviously, we saw them run to a championship while basically barely relying on a sixth and seventh guy for most of it. Like, as long as they've got...
Watson is good, too.
Yeah, Peyton Watson has come on. I mean, like, everybody last year was, like, raving about, you know, he didn't get his chance this year. He's going to be able to come... He's going to get his opportunities next year. He has validated a lot of that. You know, Christian Brown, we did see, put up a good postseason last year. Hasn't really taken the huge leap this season. But, like, I believe they're going to find... They'll get to seven or eight when they need... You know, that like Reggie Jackson is a veteran enough backup point guard, you know, whatever. I trust that. The thing that I think is going to be interesting, and we've seen teams when they cross match, you mentioned the way they guard Jokic, like loading off of Aaron Gordon and saying, prove it. Go, like, we would much rather throw more traffic in the interior and say, if you're going to hit four threes, do it. He's only taken about two a game this year. And like, that's when he hits them, you lose. When he doesn't, you know, you've got a better chance. So, like, Aaron Gordon as both like the missing piece to what makes them special and also the potential kryptonite for what, you know, if he's not going, it makes them easier and more conventional to guard is going to be something to watch there. But I think, listen, there's plenty more to get through and we'll have to watch that all as it unfolds. But I think that's all we got time for today. Patrick Redford, thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. Anything we can point people toward on the way out the door, anything you want to plug or promote, this is your opportunity to do so.
Just check out defector.com. Come subscribe to us, come hang out, and I think you'll enjoy yourself.
I firmly agree. Again, I am not just someone hosting this guy, but I am a subscriber and a supporter and a big fan. So I fully endorse that. Subscribe to Defector. That's going to do it for us here on No Cap Room. Thanks so much to super producer John Gennaro for all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. You can subscribe to the Ball Don't Lie podcast on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on. You get The Good Word with Vinny Goodwill. You get No Cap Room with me and Jake. You get Divine Intervention with me. All of that in one feed. Leave us a 5-star review, rate, review, tell a friend, whatever. We thank you so much for listening, and we would appreciate it if you would come back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.